Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. From our health and nutrition segment, we're going to talk about the autoimmune epidemic in the United States and how we're destroying our gut microorganisms, and then wonder, gee, what's wrong? The Mediterranean diet, it's good for so many things. Today I'll tell you about it, why it's good for your bones. Also, a diet that mimics fasting, and I'll explain what that is, slows down the aging process by a lot. And is your paleo diet making you irritable and depressed and sleep deprived? I'll explain why. Plus, a lot more. Then we're going to have a lot of shorter segments on themes that we don't pay attention to. For example, on cause and effect. Do we ever really stop as a nation and ask, all right, we caused some problems by going into Iraq and Afghanistan. No matter how we justify that, what were the effects? Well, Jack Blackwell, a former vet, decided to do some research. He did some good scholarly research, showed his sources, and showed how many people actually have died. Wow, you won't believe the number. Also, this is one of those segments I would call What We Deny, We Cannot Change. It's by Claire Burnish from Anti-Media, and it's about the Pentagon admitting to race-based human experiments during World War II. Mind you, they denied this as official policy for decades. Then some of the people began to talk and were interviewed. Then they had to acknowledge it. And so today, a short piece on how many people did we impact? How about over 60,000 directly we experimented on? We weren't told we were experimenting upon blacks. Why'd we experiment with them? So we need to get out of denial if we want to change being a racist nation. Also today, more than one-third of all children in the United States were physically assaulted in the last 12 months. Listen again to that. This is according to the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics. Quote, from Science Daily, University of New Hampshire, more than a third of children and teens, 17 and younger, experienced a physical assault the last 12 months. Wow. And we don't even have a dialogue on it. Also, from the segment I'm calling A Rant, from Professor Paul Greg Roberts. It's short, but it's a rant. The truth is a crime against the state. And did you know if you're traveling that depending upon where you're traveling, they're spraying pesticides on your plane, and these are dangerous. And that's why when you get to your location, you may be suffering from upper respiratory tract infections. What to do about it? I'll share that. And also today, at least we'll get started on it. Do you know that they've now have a whole new area about growing trees synthetically? The new movement is synthetic forests. And everyone you're going to hear are either MD, PhDs, or scientists in the field. And yet it's going on big time. Did you know about it? Did you know that they plan on planting 250 million acres with synthetic trees? Why? Well, I'll explain why, and they'll explain why. Well, if you're growing it synthetically, that means you're altering the DNA. That means that that could alter the entire environment around it, including the animals that use the buds and pollination and leaves and bark for food. Yeah, that's right. What happens when you put a Franken tree in nature? We don't know. So we're handling a lot of issues today. I'll get to as many as I can. I doubt if I can get to all. let's begin always with health and healing. We're suffering as a society with an epidemic of autoimmune conditions. And when I say epidemic, I'm talking about fatigue, joint pain, hair loss, infections that seem to go on and on and on, where we have all these walking wounded. They'll go to work and they'll even socialize, but they don't have the energy they once had. Far more infections than what we've ever seen, and more lost days each year. And you could look at rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, even lupus. These are all caused by the same mechanism, autoimmunity. So if you suffer from allergies, psoriasis, liver disease, which tens of millions of Americans do, or just irritable bowels, does your child have autism, inner ear infections, chemical sensitivities, then you might be surprised to find out that most of these cases start and end in your intestine. Why? Because that's where the good bacteria needs to outnumber the bad bacteria by about 90% to 10. Now, none of us will ever have 100% healthy bacteria. It's just not possible. But if you are the average American, the likelihood is you have 90% bad bacteria and 10% good, because you're feeding the bad bacteria with alcohol, sugar, rotting, rancid meats, and chemicals, refined carbohydrates, and fats. Whereas if you have 90% good bacteria, it's because you're feeding probiotics, healthy fermented foods like miso, natto, sauerkraut, for example, and or acidophilus strains from non-dairy yogurts. You also have lots of plant fibers and polyphenols, phytonutrients, and hopefully supplements as well. That is what creates healthy bacteria. The healthier you are in your gut, the healthier your heart, the healthier your brain. So what are some of the biggest things that can destroy the bacteria and put you at risk of autoimmune epidemics? The flu shot and vaccines. According to Natural News, quote, vaccines are repeat offenders when it comes to ingesting toxins that destroy immunity, especially flu shots that get people into sick condition every year. What easier way to annihilate the immune system than injecting embalming fluid, true, formaldehyde, mercury, true, 24 micrograms, aluminum, true, into the muscle tissue. And that is going to have unnatural reactions to your hormones, your central nervous system, and your brain, and your gut. You're going to genetically modify bacteria. You're going to end up getting live viruses, chicken embryos, aborted fetal proteins, all in that flu shot. So just imagine what that does to the good bacteria in your digestive system, and then imagine what happens to your immune system when you've altered your bacteria. So more than 290 million Americans get their shot every year. Little do they know about building natural immunity, fostering good gut flora and microbes. If you were to take coconut oil each day, that is terrific for your immune system, turning off inflammation in the body, especially in your gut, and helping the body create healthy bacteria. Spirulina. All of your organic sprouted foods, I commonly refer to sprouted nuts and seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, that's what our gut needs. And then if you do have a bad gut, then the oil of oregano, garlic, cinnamon, licorice, all help kill bad bacteria and help build immunity and get you healthy. Also, soda. Sodas annihilate gut bacteria, and yet in hot weather, it's nothing for a teenager to put down three or four of them in a day. They're loaded with high fructose corn syrup, and that is terrible. That's loaded with it's made from genetically modified corn and contains pesticides, and that in turn destroys gut flora, ruining your immunity and making your body more susceptible to catching colds and infectious disease. Also, it creates a very acidic condition. Not good, and can lead to kidney disease and lower bone density. It's been linked to kidney stones. And then pesticides, which are everywhere, kill the flora, the good bacteria. And these are all genetically modified, and they're bad for us. They go on our food, which is bad for us. So the two together really are terrible. And then fluoride in our water supply, nobody thinks that it's bad. It is. Tap water contains the fluoride, and that's terrible for our body. And then gluten, especially the glue-like, sticky mass of wheat protein, and it plays havoc on a lot of people. So if you eliminate the one group of foods and chemicals and you start eating a healthier plant-based diet, then you should have a strong immune system. The Mediterranean diet is not just about the diet. It's about an attitude, the importance of family, taking time not to overwork or stress, not rushing through a meal. And for those of you who've been to the Mediterranean area, you know they take it very seriously. I mean, the whole country kind of closes down from noon to about 3 to 4 o'clock, and then they open up again and work a little later than we do. Well, it's important to realize that there are certain things within the diet that are extremely beneficial. And at the top of that list would be olives, and from the olives, olive oil. And this is a study, one of many studies, that showed that the fruits and vegetables, good for you, but that 2 to 4 tablespoons a day of olive oil, terrific for you, especially the extra virgin first pressed. And that is one of the things to help your bones. A new study shows that olive oil consumption impacts the bones, helps with the mineralization of the bones in a major way. This was a big clinical study, and it proved the importance of olive oil and bones. So it has phenolic compounds in the olive oil, and that supports the mineralization. And which minerals help you have strong bones? Calcium and magnesium, but also phosphorus and manganese, vitamin D and vitamin K all work together with boron and the bioflavonoids and genistein, really strong bones. And finally, a diet that mimics fasting appears to slow aging. This is from the University of Southern California. Quote, want to lose abdominal fat, get smarter, and live longer? New research led by University of California's Walter Longo shows that periodically adopting a diet that mimics the effects of fasting may yield a wide range of health benefits. In a new study, he and colleagues show that cycles of a 4-day low-calorie diet that mimics fasting cuts viscerally the body fat and elevated the number of progenitor and stem cells in several organs of old mice, including the brain, where it boosted neural regeneration and improved learning and memory. And that's the takeaway message. I'm working with a lot of people now whose parents suffer from some form of brain aging, generally manifested as dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, memory loss. And one of the first things that I've done, and we've gotten some very, very promising results and sustained, is put them on a caloric-restricted diet. Now, they're getting all they need, plus a lot more, but they're not getting it in high caloric dense foods. Like, meat is very high in calories. People don't realize that, but it is. And so is a carbonated beverage, a sugar beverage. You're getting water and sugar. Not good. So if you start getting lots of vegetables and even a plate, just for a lunch, make some fresh hummus with lots of garlic and lemon juice or lime juice and cayenne pepper, and then have around that some lightly grilled vegetables, eggplant, zucchinis, onions, tomatoes, and then dip the hummus, put it on the vegetables. What a nice, simple lunch. You see, the idea of sitting down to one big meal is just a mistake. You should graze. Grazing is the best, healthiest thing you could possibly do. You eat small quantities of food throughout the day, hence never spiking your blood sugar, but keeping it up and keeping the nutrients coming in, fibers coming in, so you're always involved in peristalsis, the wave-like rhythmic movement, so your intestine is cleaning material out as new as coming in. No constipation, none of the likelihood of polyps or colorectal cancer. You're keeping your blood sugar and your blood pressure normal, especially if you're using onions and garlic in there, and there's really a delicious way of taking, I like to take, and this is a nice simple dish also. You take a sweet onion, slice it in the slice that you would like, run it under cold water for just about 30 seconds. Now then put a lot of lemon juice on it, squeeze fresh lemon juice, and then some Himalayan sea salt, and then spray mustard on it, or put a thin layer of mustard on it. Then put a nice big tomato slice on there, and then thin slices of cucumber, and then put some baba ganoush made from eggplant on top of that, and that's a meal. Low calories, highly nutritious, lots of fiber, lots of polyphenols and antioxidants. So that helps your body live longer. You burn body fat, you feel better, and it helps the brain. It's not difficult. On tomorrow's show, I'll deal with the paleo diet, because we have a lot of other things to cover today. And we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to look at synthetic forest. Please stay with us. Whoa, 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 whoa. In the next day or two, all of our phone lines will be hooked back up, and we'll have 10 lines that people can call in on. We've been moving into our new studios, and hence we cannot take calls, but that'll change. And I wanted to ask you this question. I'm going to ask it now, and I'd like for you to think about it. Allow it to roll around in your mind. This is from the University of New Hampshire, as published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics, as presented in Science Daily. More than, quote, a third of children were physically assaulted in the United States last year. For example, the findings show 40.9% of all children and youth had more than one direct experience of violence, crime, or abuse. 37% experienced physical assault during the study year. 5% experienced sexual offense. That's a lot of people. Girls 14 to 17 were the group at highest risk of sexual assault, with 16.4% experiencing sexual offense, and that's terrible. 15.2% of children and youth experienced maltreatment by a caregiver, including physical abuse, and 24.5% witnessed violence in the family or community. And, quote, from the study, children and youth are exposed to violence, abuse, and crime in varied and extensive ways, which justifies continued monitoring and preventative efforts. Okay, so here's my question. Why? Why have we become so a violent nation? Why? What are your thoughts? I have my own, but I'd rather hear yours. Now, I will ask you to call in and share your thoughts, assuming our phones are up and running tomorrow, which the phone companies here says should be. Now for a little rant time. And one of the smartest ranters in America is Professor Paul Craig Roberts. This is short. It's called Truth is a Crime Against the State. Quote, the entire Western edifice rests on lies. There is no other foundation, just lies. This makes truth an enemy. Enemies have to be suppressed, and thus truth has to be suppressed. Truth comes from foreign news services such as RT and from internet sites such as this one. Truth, Washington, and its vassals are busy at work closing down independent media. Washington and its vassals have redefined propaganda. Truth is propaganda if it is told by countries, such as Russia or China, that have independent foreign policies. Propaganda is truth if told by Washington and its puppets, such as the European Union. The European Union Observer, little doubt following Washington's orders, has denounced RT and Sputnik News for, quote, broadcasting fabrications and hate speech from their bureaus in Europe, European Union cities. Often I appear on both RT and Sputnik. In my opinion, both are too restrained in their reporting, fearful, of course, of being shut down than full truth requires. I've never heard a word of hate speech or propaganda on either. Washington's propaganda, perhaps, but not the Russian government. In other words, the Washington has the news world rigged. Not even independent news sites can speak completely clearly. The Western press succeeded in creating a false reality, and Americans accept it. A sizable percentage of these people believe that Russia invaded the Ukraine, but that's a lie, and that Russia is threatening to invade the Baltic states and Poland, another lie. This belief exists despite all intelligence of all Western governments reporting that there's no sign of any Russian forces that would be required for invasion. The Russian invasion, like the Saddam Hussein weapons of mass destruction and Al-Qaeda connections, like Assad of Syria's use of chemical weapons against his own people, and like Iranian nukes, never existed, but nevertheless became the reality of Washington's media. The Western people believe in non-existent occurrences. In other words, just to state the obvious, non-controversial fact, the Western news media is a propaganda ministry of which no truth emerges. End quote. And that's his rant. Now, something that is not a rant, but what I call cause and effect. I believe that any of our actions, our deeds, our words will have an impact, positive or negative, on some varying degree. But when I do a documentary, and I've done three on Iraq, latest being Friendly Fire, and I interview over 1,000 American veterans, and they tell me stories of what they saw and what they participated in and how they feel about it, and I don't see this represented in the media. So are we able to create a reality for other people and then walk away from it? For example, right now, Jerry Brown signed into law the vaccine bill in California, which allows no exemptions. Now, that contradicts what he previously had written, that parents have a right to decide, you know, the health input of their family. And the ones who are most strongly against vaccines, mandatory vaccines, are the most educated at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. These are PhDs. These are very intelligent people who did the research and said, the research does not give me confidence that this schedule of vaccines or this particular vaccine or at this age is going to benefit my child and may pose a risk. That's a reasonable and responsible response when you look at the thousands of articles that support that. But now they have no choice. So when the legislators have been bought, and we've shown you how much they were given, and when we show you that they lie, and we've given specific cases of their lying to get this passed, when everyone's colluding together, then what is the likely outcome? Well, the likely outcome is we're going to have far more kids diagnosed with autism, autoimmune disorders, and death. But do they care? I've never seen a legislator anywhere at the state or federal level come back before the public, call a press conference, say, you know something? I got to tell you the truth. I wasn't an expert on this particular topic. I believe the so-called experts, but then I didn't look to see where they aligned with special interest groups. In reality, these were just propagandists, no matter what PhD or MD degrees they had in front of their names. They were paid for. They made promises to me. They helped me in my campaign, etc. And so I bent to their will. And now I have to tell you, I feel bad about this. I feel bad about compromising my own principles, at least the ones that I knew I had. Have we ever had that politician come forward? No. And we're not. But let us be very clear that on every action there is a reaction. With every cause there is an effect. And that's why I call this segment Cause and Effect. I'm quoting from Jack Balkwill, and this is from Counterpunch, a very important and reputable publication. It's short, but listen carefully to what he has to say. Mind you, the New York Times and the Washington Post and Frontline and 60 Minutes all together have not given you the information this one former vet gives you. Quote, "The mass media in the United States have covered up the most important fact in America's ongoing wars, the number of people slaughtered. Even before the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, the mainstream media served as cheerleaders for the bloodshed, spreading the major lies that led to war. As a combat vet, still shocked by what I saw almost 50 years ago in Vietnam, where we slaughtered millions in another war based on lies, I decided to look into what is happening in the current wars. I discovered that as many as 7 million innocents may have been slaughtered in Afghanistan and Iraq. I say innocents because even most combatants American forces have killed were merely defending their homelands from invasions by foreigners. The invasion of Afghanistan was avoidable. The Taliban had offered to give up bin Laden if the USA would show them proof that he was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The invasion of Iraq, meanwhile, violated international law and was little more than genocide. I first looked for government or mainstream media reports in researching this article, but found little help there, forcing me to conclude that they are not at all interested in counting victims. Anything they put out to date is so simplistic that it should be ignored by anyone seeking the truth. They wouldn't even report on taking seriously a 2006 report by the respected UK medical journal The Lancet, which based upon household surveys and other data concluded that between March 2003 invasion of Iraq and the beginning of 2006, Iraq suffered over 650 war-related deaths, representing an astonishing 2.5% of the country's population. As for the people of Iraq are concerned, the Iraq War is now 25 years old. It began in 1990 with deadly economic sanctions imposed on Iraq, followed by a 1991 attack by George Bush against Iraq forces. The sanctions after the hot war ended continued during the subsequent hot war with President Clinton's Operation Desert Fox and continued until sanctions were finally lifted in 2003 as the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq was launched by George W. Bush, a variation of the continued assault on Iraq as on Iraqis. And then it says, while the corporate U.S. media ignored it, even Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, in 1996, acknowledged studies showing that over 500,000 Iraqi children died because of the sanctions, but concluded on 60 Minutes by stating, quote, the genocidal slaughter was, quote, worth it. But all that was before 2003 shock and awe attack on Iraq. A 2007 Opinion Research Business of London estimated the number of Iraqis killed in 2003 invasion of that country and the following war up to that time was 1.2 million. Take these numbers from the invasion, sanctions, and occupation of Iraq alone and you're 2.5 million dead. And then you have Afghanistan. And then it goes on to summarize Noam Chomsky, a report in 2002, quote, a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, we are facing a humanitarian crisis of epic proportion in Afghanistan with 7.5 million short of food and at risk of starvation. No one has counted how many of those people died because they were outside of the main cities, but already they were at death's door. And what did the war do? Well, it drove them further out. So we're not even counting those dead. But a study by a professor Gideon Paola after on the effect of the war on Afghanistan population, concluded as a result of the invasion occupation up to 2009, quote, this carnage involved 4.5 million post-invasion violent and nonviolent excess Afghan deaths. And that continues, an Afghan Holocaust and Afghan genocide is defined by Article 2 of the UN Genocide Convention. So, if this estimate is correct, there are 4.5 million dead in Afghanistan, minimally, as a result of the invasion occupation, combined with 2.5 million dead from war and sanctions in Iraq, we arrive at the figure of 7 million dead. But if 7 million people died, why is it that so few seem aware of these numbers? After all, anyone you ask on the street can tell you of genocides, but why can't they talk about 7 million dying there? And it's cause and effect. It's a very valid point. Should we be continuing to do what we do around the world to countries without ever considering the consequences or the effect? I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a few minutes, I'll play more later, to play a bit of a series of experts being interviewed. These are PhDs and MDs and scientists on the subject of synthetic forests, the new making trees by the billions of trees so that they can profit from them.
The prospect of GE trees and the corporations that are pushing this technology, it's really breathtaking. I mean, they're looking at 184 million acres of forests around the world. So their dream is to cut down all those forests and instead have these industrial, monocultured, essentially tree factories. No insects, no birds, no ecosystem, no life. These trees aren't really even trees. Any natural behavior of a tree is inhibited. So imagine that. That's their dream. That is where they're going to make their money. Down go all the forests, up come these tree factories, millions and millions of acres, these monocultures, whether they're going to be eucalyptus or poplar. That's their dream. That's going to be all these trees that they're then going to cut down and plant every couple of years for fuel.
They actually want to release 500 million genetically engineered trees all over the Southeast for biomass burning every single year.
Recently, Congress set a goal for cellulosic biofuel production, 22 billion gallons. The USDA projects that the Southeast, with its natural diversity and its long growing season, will produce half of that total, nearly 11 billion gallons.
But the second biggest use for atrazine in the U.S. is in forestry. So when the trees are cut, my understanding is the atrazine is then applied aerially to prevent any weeds or competition from growing up while they replant the trees. Atrazine is the number one contaminant of drinking water, surface water, rainwater, aquifers, groundwater, you name it, atrazine's in it. Atrazine's associated or correlated with a number of reproductive health problems in humans. So, for example, it's associated with low sperm count, it's associated with an increase in breast cancer, it's associated with an increase in prostate cancer, it's associated with at least 3 birth defects.
And I think we've all probably experienced what happens when a poplar tree goes into cross-pollination. It's almost like a snow event. The pollen is so prolific and travels so far.
The pollen blowing on the wind that we breathe, certainly the inhalation route is just as powerful as consuming.
In 2009, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine reviewed the animal feeding studies and said these animals are so sick and suffering, no one should be eating GMOs. They're suffering from gastrointestinal problems, immune problems, reproductive problems, accelerated aging, organ damage, and problems with cholesterol and insulin. So we've seen since then more evidence that GMOs are unsafe, both at the laboratory level, among livestock that are switched from GM to non-GM or vice versa, and we can see the differences in their health, and to humans who've stopped eating GMOs, and they and their physicians, by the thousands now prescribing non-GMO diets, describe health improvements. What's going to happen if they introduce plums or apples that are genetically engineered? It could affect every other plum and apple seller in the country and export markets.
We are contributing to the evolution of this story, applying biotechnology in the development of genetically modified trees, such as eucalyptus, aiming to enhance our company's competitiveness.
That means that if these companies are trying to engineer eucalyptus to have even more volatile oils, that could really raise some serious questions about what would happen if there were an adverse event like a fire. That might actually help spread the fire, because at least in California, some of those eucalyptus trees were just like torches. When the fires would get high and were blowing through the Oakland Hills, they would almost explode, and they helped exacerbate the whole problem of wildfires in California.
So when you burn wood, per unit of energy generation, you actually release more carbon into the atmosphere than you would if you were burning coal. The other thing is that burning wood for electricity produces a whole bunch of other pollutants, including particulates, very fine particulates like ultrafine and nanoparticulates, which are very, very damaging to human health because they can bypass all of the protective mechanisms in the lungs and enter directly into bypass cell membranes and deliver straight into the bloodstream.
We're already seeing, you know, massive plantations in places like Brazil in those kind of tropical and subtropical climates down there, and they're a disaster. Any monoculture is going to be a disaster, and anything at the wrong scale is going to be a disaster. But and so if you add GE trees to the kind of monoculture plantations that are already in existence down there, you just exacerbate a really bad problem, making it worse.
And now they come in with the GE trees to make things worse. You know, the industrial tree monocultures are already very bad for communities. We have done 20 years of studies and talking with communities, and all the places communities complain that we didn't ask for these plantations, and they have caused a lot of problems. They have removed many people, and now with the GE trees, things will get worse, because these trees are coming in, can come in more regions. If these trees are resistant to the herbicides, they can speed up the cycle. The cycle is like 5 years. For these biomass plantations, the cycle is 1 to 2 years. And they will plant more trees per hectare. For a pulpwood plantation, they plant between 1,500 and 2,000 trees. For a biomass plantation, they will plant up to 8,000 trees. And with the GE trees technology, they think they can more than duplicate the production.
You know, the forests do not need agriculture.
And that's just a little bit of information. There'll be a lot more coming on synthetic forests. A whole lot of that is on our website, by the way. And also, the Pentagon, this is from Claire Burnish of Antimedia, the Pentagon admits to race-based human experiments during World War II. Quote, the U.S. Army has finally admitted to conducting experiments on human subjects with chemical weapons throughout World War II, simply because they were African Americans, Japanese Americans, or Puerto Rican. With America's dysfunctional inability to discuss the country's underlying systemic racism, once again diverted thanks to a flag, a troubling investigation has shown the truth. Roughly 1 million black men served in World War II face the shameful double standard of fighting for the very country that viewed them with suspicion and hate. Troops of color were ruthlessly discriminated against by their superiors and forced to clean and cook for white soldiers, among other demeaning tasks. Segregation was the rule from the barracks to the battlefield. 60,000 of those enlisted minority men were singled out to cruelly and unwittingly serve as the Army's human test subjects to determine how mustard gas would react when contact to skin. Though white subjects were also used, they served as the control group to establish what was normal in comparison to the skin of minorities. Federal officials initially admitted to using humans in testing in 1991, but it wasn't until now that documentation and interviews with survivors that the true nature of these experiments became apparent. And one of these people was experimented on, was told that they were the ideal chemical soldier. An entire racial group was able to act as a buffer on the front lines, absorbing the majority of the chemical attack, while white troops waited for the effects to dissipate. Though the Army conceded the race-based nature of the experiments, the true reasons for testing remain undisclosed. Roland Edwards survived his ordeal as an Army test subject. The 93-year-old carried something with him for years to prove as much as anyone who doubted him, a jar to hold the flakes of skin that continued to scale off from his after effects of the chemical some 70 years later. So, what we deny, we cannot change. And for those of you who are flying, there are certain places that if you fly, you won't know that before you get on the airplane, they're spraying pesticides in there. I actually was on an airplane early, flying out of the country, and saw them spraying. I asked to see the container. The flight attendant kindly gave it to me. I looked at the chemicals. I said, this is a toxin. This is a carcinogen. Well, we have to spray it every flight. And if you go to Ecuador, Grenada, India, Madagascar, Trinidad, Tobago, Uruguay, a lot of places they are spraying. And my suggestion is wear an ionizer and wear a mask because it's going to stay in the air. And then take lots of vitamin C, take a green juice with you, or make a green juice, take some powders, make some green juice. The chlorophyll helps you, as well as garlic and onion. We're finishing up getting our studios ready, and I'm going to be hiring some people who can do painting and also who do light carpentry. If you'd like to be hired for a week, and it pays good. I pay always good money. You can call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and help us get the studio done even a little sooner. I want you to hear this. I think this is very important and very timely.
Joining us on the phone is Michelle Roten, and she is the founder, I believe, of Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. We spoke to her back on May the 1st, because it's very important as we see all these bills coming across the United States for mandatory vaccines to understand this has been going on for a long time. And of course, it's not just in schools as we're seeing the main thrust right now. It's been against people in the health professions, especially telling them they could not work unless they got vaccines. So we talked to her about that initially, and she had a bombshell revelation within that context, telling us about the harmful effects that she had witnessed firsthand on children in neonatal intensive care, premature infants, who were given the vaccines on schedule regardless of their physical condition. And of course, their physical condition was not the same as a baby that had gone full term that was 2 months old. These were children that were born prematurely, and even though they were born just a couple of months ago, they were still on the same vaccine schedule. Now, before we get into the interview with an update from the Journal of the American Medical Association validating what Michelle had said, when I give you her qualifications, of course, she is a master science in nursing. We have a lot of initials after her name. I just want you to understand what these are if you're not a medical professional. The master science in nursing, registered nurse certified, a nursing interventions classification certification, certified in neonatal pediatric support, and a neonatal nurse practitioner with board certification. Michelle is highly qualified, highly trained, but most importantly, she has an ethics and a morality that we see lacking in pretty much every field today, but especially now in medicine. When she blew the whistle on this practice, when she put herself out there and talked about things that other people were not doing, it's very, very important, because if you don't have ethics, if you don't have morality, all the training and certification and knowledge that you get just makes you more dangerous. And that's what we're seeing right now in the medical profession. So joining us now is Michelle Roten with Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. Thank you for joining us, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a correction that I'm not the founder of Nurses Against Mandatory Vaccines. I'm a founding board member, so I'm one of the original members, but Amy Kenyon is actually the founder.
Okay, good. Now, I want to go back and recall for our viewers what you told us on May 1st that you had seen being done with young babies, premature babies who were suffering in the neonatal intensive care, what they were saying about vaccines at the time.
Well, I had mentioned that they go ahead and vaccinate premature infants on time, meaning that once they are 2 months old, they're ready for their 2 month vaccines, regardless of the fact that they may still have supposed to have been inside their mother's stomachs and not even born yet. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that we're seeing and are being said are things like a neonatologist calling from the step-down unit down to level three to the more intensive unit saying, hey, I'm going to give these four babies their two-month vaccines this weekend, so I just want to make sure you had four beds ready because we know they're all going to have issues and need increased care.
And that was bombshell information because that violates one of the core ethics of the medical foundation profession that we've always seen, and that is first do no harm. They knew this was going to harm the children, but they were going to go ahead and blindly or follow this schedule.
Absolutely. You know, and I mentioned that I had sat in a call room before with a bunch of providers saying, hey, we have this 25-weeker that was so strong, they never required intubation with a breathing tube to actually go onto the vent, had a less invasive type respiratory support. And you come in and they're like, oh, how embarrassing. We gave that baby his two-month immunizations and now he's intubated on the vent for the first time. Oops.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of blown off.
That was amazing. So you told us that on May 1st. And then you contacted me last week and told me about this JAMA study, a Journal of American Medical Association, the official organization of MDs. And here they do a study about the adverse effects after routine immunization of extremely low birth weight infants. Tell us about that study.
Well, first, extremely low birth weight infants are 28 weeks in gestation or less, or under 1,000 grams, approximately 2.2 pounds or less at birth. And you had a group of physicians and a practitioner that went into a database of a large neonatology corporation with almost 14,000 infants looked at. And what the results said were that they were looking at the pre-immunization period versus the post-immunization period, and their sepsis workups went up 3.7 times in the post-immunization period. And sepsis means a blood infection. And so there's multiple labs drawn, blood cultures, urine cultures. They go ahead and they start those babies on antibiotics right away while they wait for results. So it's not a benign thing.
Yeah, it's life-threatening, isn't it?
Right. It's life-threatening. And even if it ends up not being an infection, they've still had pain, they've had invasive procedures, and they've had antibiotics given, which is not a benign thing for these babies that have very sensitive intestines. And so it's a big deal. And then we had increased respiratory support 2 times higher in the post-immunization period. And then intubation, actually getting intubated with a breathing tube and going on the vent, was about 1.7, 1.8 times higher. And what really shocked me, I had to read it about 3 times, was when I got down to the conclusion, they said, based on this, there was no difference in reaction between single shots and combo shots. And so you can just go ahead and keep giving the combo vaccines.
Isn't that amazing? That was the only thing they were concerned about. Can we tweak this a little bit by giving them a combo vaccine or a singular vaccine? No, it doesn't make any difference. So go ahead and do this to them, even though, and to repeat these numbers, 112% increase in respiratory support needed post-vaccine. This is the Journal of American Medical Association saying this. A 257% increase in sepsis. That's a life-threatening infection. Just go ahead and do it because we have to follow this vaccination schedule. That is the most important thing to them, isn't it? It isn't the patient's health. It isn't their suffering. It isn't subjecting them to life-threatening situations. It's sticking to the vaccine schedule.
Right. I mean, just to clarify, they didn't actually have sepsis increase that much, but they are saying that they had that big of an increase in testing, surveying, and starting to treat for sepsis, mm-hmm. Which basically just says, when I talked in that other interview, that these babies have apnea and bradycardia is a nice example that they're having a hard time, you know, remembering to breathe. And so then their heart rate drops and things like that. That's a lot of what they're seeing, temp instability, inability to tolerate feeds. And so these babies are vastly showing big cues that we're normally extremely concerned about in the pre-immunization period or any time before discharge, because these babies have immune systems that are so underdeveloped that if you wait too long to treat them, they are going to have very bad outcomes and possibly die. But in the post-immunization period, we're seeing an increase in that, And apparently we're not worried because the whole point of the study was to make sure that these babies get vaccinated on time and that it doesn't matter what you're vaccinating with.
You know, when we look at these babies with low birth weights or premature babies, they're really, I think, canaries in a coal mine. We have to look at this and say, if they have this many, this much of an increase in respiratory issues in response to these vaccinations, I wonder, personally, if there's some connection to SIDS. A lot of people have talked about sudden infant death syndrome and just babies that stop breathing. I wonder if there's, we don't have anything to back that up in this study, but certainly it makes you wonder, makes me wonder when I look at all of these respiratory issues that are caused for these babies that already have a challenged health system.
Well, there's two ways to look at it. You know, premature babies are not supposed to be breathing yet. It is normal for them to have some apnea and bradycardia. Just developmental-wise and immature neurological systems. But having an increase is always a cue that something is going on. They don't address that in that study. We do have some studies from, I believe, the 50s following the DTaP shot showing increased or just apnea, but also just a vast change in respiratory breathing patterns. And of course,
so that was just a report, and it shows you how corrupt medicine is. Now imagine that you live in California and you have a premature baby, already greater risk of death and brain dysfunction. And now we know from all of the science of immunology that baby doesn't have an immune system apart from what the mother's given it, and it takes time to develop and won't even be able to develop antibodies immediately. And yet you're putting antibodies, foreign antibodies, that are highly toxic, that are carcinogens, directly into that baby system. And we wonder why we have so many that suffer these injuries. It's just, it needs to be exposed. But until someone inside the medical community exposes it, nothing will be done. So now you're facing California. What do you do? You have seen that your legislature, at least the majority of them, who voted for these bills and the governor, don't respect what it is to be a parent and know the responsibilities that a parent has, especially those who are well-educated. Ironically, the more educated the parents on what the child needs, the more likely you are to be considered incapable of parenting, and therefore the state should parent for you, make the decisions. And these can be life and death. Also, we have not yet had any major health official from the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, come forward and say, for the 2 million parents who have children with autism, we're sorry. No one apologizes. They just double down and say, wasn't the vaccines, even though we can show a 6,000% increase in autism from the time they started these vaccines till now. And countries that do not have our vaccine scheduled don't have that epidemic of autism. We refuse to look at anyone else's science. We refuse to even acknowledge our own, and we falsify our own. So you've got a couple options. One of those options is protest and bring lawsuits. Secondly is move. I believe that there is no greater place that we need to move from than California right now. Nevada, yes. Arizona, yes. And California. And this is just one more reason when you're, it's one thing to have the environment against you with the loss of water, with being on an earthquake fault, with forest fires. It's something else when you have your rights taken away from you. Time to look for another place. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.
To me.